Hello, everyone, and welcome to Module 3 of Advanced Aromatherapy, Therapeutic Application of Essential Oils for Clarity, Health, and Happiness, with David Crow, titled Therapeutic Categories of Essential Oils. This is your host, Colleen, at the Shift Network. Just a reminder that you can find all the handouts for each module on the course homepage when you open the module itself. If at any time you have a technical issue or question and you're on the phone on Maestro, you can press 5 on your telephone keypad. I will come along and assist you. And if you're on the webcast, please type directly into the message box and provide your email so we can reply by email. That covers it today, so let's bring on David. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Colleen. Welcome back to everybody all over the world. And let's go ahead and get started with Module 3. So if you would take a moment and open the files, as we always do. You can find these on the course page under Module 3, and you will see that we have 5 files for today. We have a file titled Botanical Therapeutic Categories. This is our primary discussion this week. And we have a file titled Lavender Studies. This is some information for you to read through, and also we'll have a little discussion about it. We have Oil Monographs. And this will be where we start looking in detail at the various uses of specific species of essential oils. And these oils are some of the primary oils from the topic of botanical therapeutic categories. In other words, they are good examples of what we're talking about. And then we have a file titled The Primary Functions of Botanical Therapeutic Categories. And then we have our deepening practices. Okay, so I always like to address as many of the questions and concerns that come in on the webcast as possible, and also have some time for question and answer. Our schedule today, we will go until 6:30 California time. That's an hour and a half, 90 minutes of lecture, and then we will open it up for some discussion. But I always like to start with some discussion and answers about some of the questions that have come in through both the webcast and the email, the consulting email, my personal address there, because many times there are themes that emerge, and I can actually answer several people's questions all at once. And so one of the themes that came out of last week has to do with some of the controversial issues of essential oils, and of course that's what last week was about, because if we are going to be using essential oils, we need to know how concentrated they are, and we need to know the safe uses, and we also need to know what things are being said about them that are misleading and potentially dangerous. And so one of the themes of several questions was people pointed out that one of the statements that's made by several companies is that these oils are generally recognized as safe. That is a term, that's a legal term, GRAS, generally recognized as safe. And what this means is that they can be considered food grade. And this is one of the types of statements that is used in a misleading way. And I will explain why and how. Basically, if you say that something is generally recognized as safe, that doesn't mean that you can just consume it. However, let's take the example of peppermint oil. Peppermint oil is generally recognized as safe. And what this term refers to specifically is its use as a flavoring agent. And so that means that it is put into toothpaste and it's put into various food items and so forth. But because it is generally recognized as safe does not mean that it is safe to consume it directly. Therefore, you have to look at how that term is being misrepresented, because if it is generally recognized as safe, it means within a particular food industry context, and that means that the use of peppermint oil commercially is going to be highly diluted, and that's all that we're concerned about. We're only concerned about biocompatible levels of application. Now, I'm sure that if you bought a toothpaste and it had an extraordinarily high level of pure peppermint oil in it, that after even one use, you might have an inflammatory reaction and you wouldn't buy that product again. And so therefore, that's not how it's used. It is used in a highly dilute form, and the general range would be something like 0.1% to 0.01% in a blend. And that's the difference, and that is the key to understanding how that particular statement is misleading. And that is that just because it is generally recognized as safe by the FDA for food additive purposes does not mean that you can drink it. It means that it can be used in particular products in certain dilutions. Okay, so that was one thing that people have brought up, and that is another complexity of marketing statements. And other people were curious about the term therapeutic grade. And again, I will just reiterate that the reason that this is somewhat of a problematic term is because there is no such grade. There is simply no such grading system at all, and so any use of that particular term is basically meaningless. And another theme that has come up both in the webcast questions and the consulting email box is that people are reporting that they are hearing stories and seeing situations that are bringing to their attention how people are being injured with the improper use of essential oils. And they are concerned and they want to know, what can I do to stop this? And how do I tell these people who believe that these oils are perfectly safe to take internally or to apply directly on the skin without any risk? Or how do I tell these people that think that because it's supposedly pure and natural therapeutic grade that it means that it's perfectly safe to do whatever you want with it? How do I inform these people that there are potential risks? Well, I think that it depends on the situation, and what's most important to me personally is that I simply bring this information to you for your awareness. And I'm not the only person who is educating people about the dangers of essential oils. There are now many, many people and websites dedicated to this and to the reporting of adverse reactions and so forth. And this is in response to the huge number of adverse reactions and poisoning cases that are happening. And there's a lot of people who would really like to have essential oils in the future, not have them taken away, not be damaged by them, and so forth. And so my responsibility is to simply tell you about how to use them safely, that's all, and tell you about the issues that are happening in the industry. And now that I have told you all of that, we can move on into our therapeutic applications. We don't have to dwell on this any further, because my job as the teacher of this course is to tell you how to use these things safely. But because it's a very complicated industry, as I explained in quite a bit of detail last week, we should know about it. And that has some very practical applications, not just so you don't hurt yourself or others, but also so that you are very aware of the quality control issues and so forth. Now, in terms of what you can do, the number one thing is that you can use the oil safely. That would be the most gratifying, satisfying thing for me personally, is just to know that I was able to talk to all of you for 6 months, almost 300 people for 6 months, and nobody got hurt using essential oils incorrectly. That would be a wonderful thing. And nobody had any complaints. Nobody got contact dermatitis, nobody burned their tongue, nobody burned their esophagus, nobody did anything incorrectly with them. And that's entirely possible. All we have to do is just use them carefully, use them safely, use them appropriately, and there will be no problems. And if you do that, then you will be an example to all the other people who are saying, yes, but I do this and I do that. And the appropriate response, as I mentioned last week, is yes, these things do help people. And yes, sometimes if you put it directly on the skin, it can treat this. And sometimes if you take it internally, it can treat that. But the risk is high. And the margin between a therapeutic dose and a toxic dose is extremely narrow. And there are individual differences. And one person may get a lot of benefit by taking a drop or two of oregano oil on their tongue at the onset of a sore throat, and another person might end up in the hospital. That's the answer to that question, is just because these oils help some people some of the time does not mean that they are free of risk. That's what we have to consider. And so please just put this in the bigger context that this is advanced herbal medicine. This is the most concentrated form of herbal medicine. And so let's just follow that and use it, use all these oils very respectfully. All right, now let's jump into our talk today. And what we are doing here is, again, a larger overview of many species of oils. And this, in a certain way, is a different version of what we did in Module 1. In Module 1, we organized essential oils into large therapeutic categories according to the Ayurvedic terminology and some Chinese medicine terminology, and that allowed us to make a segue from the 7-week Ayurvedic aromatherapy program so that people who were in that could get a bit more of that and could see all of it consolidated into one place, and people who were not in that course could have an introduction to it. And as I mentioned at that particular time, the reason that we do that is because we can learn a lot about a lot of essential oils very quickly and efficiently. And the reason for that is because many oils share similar therapeutic properties. At the same time, many oils share many chemical compounds. There are families of oils based on the same compound. And if you have a family of oils that has the same compound, there's a very high likelihood that it will also have a very similar aromatic profile, that many things will smell very similar. And these can then be classified according to whether they are heating or cooling, or whether they are rich in earth, water, fire, air, or space elements, whether they are specifically for stimulating or for relaxing, whether they're good for the prana or whether they're good for the yin or the yang and the soma and the agni. And that's what we looked at in Module 1. Now, what we're going to look at in this module is to do the same exercise from a different perspective and go a little bit deeper into the therapeutic functions of these groups by organizing everything into botanical therapeutic categories. So this method of organizing the species of oils is not based on whether they are yin or yang, not based on whether they are earth, water, fire, air, space, not based on whether they are for prana, ojas, soma, and so forth. It's based on whether they come from flowers, or from fruits, or from spices, or from woods and resins, or from tree leaves. And so if you look through this particular file titled Botanical Therapeutic Categories, what I have done here is I have organized a wide range of oils into categories that are mostly botanical. There's a few exceptions to that, but most of this is a botanical way of organizing this. And so if you would just look at what we have here, an extensive list. And if you now unpack this and talk about the therapeutic benefits of each of these categories, and you combine that with a discussion from last week about the safe uses of applying the oils in various ways, the proper dilutions and diffusers and so forth, then you could actually start to do extensive use of essential oils for safe aromatherapy purposes. So the first category is what we could call medicinal flowers. Let's go through this first. One pass through this file, and then I'm going to come back and we're going to spend quite a bit of time unpacking this, all the various details of each of these categories. So medicinal flowers is something that can be defined very simply. These are basically oils that come from flowers that are used primarily for medicinal purposes. The next category, read this for you here. We have two species of chamomile. We have clary sage. We have geranium. We have helichrysum. We have lavender. And we have rhododendron. Now, this is not an inclusive list by any means, but these are some of the oils that are most easily recognizable, easy to find on the market, easy to use, and so forth. Now, these all have a wide range of medicinal applications, aromatherapy, both for applications to the skin and for inhalation and other uses as well. Now, the next category are flowers that we could call exotic. And so what's the difference? Well, the exotic flowers are also medicinal. That's something important to remember here, is just because they're exotic does not mean that they're not therapeutic. It means that they also have some additional characteristics. And how we define exotic will basically help us understand the difference. And so exotic basically means, first of all, that these tend to be very expensive. And if we look at it, what we see is that it's champaka, which is a type of magnolia from India. It's a co-distillation of geranium and rose petals, which is a wonderful type of oil where two things are put together in the still. It's two types of jasmine, dawn blooming and night blooming, and these are the two most common species that are found. Lotuses, neroli, the orange blossom, and rose. Now, if you look at this particular list, you can probably get a sense of what is meant by exotic. These come from faraway places. They are very expensive, and usually the medicinal flowers tend to sell in larger bottles, like say a half ounce size, maybe in the $20 to $30 range, maybe a little higher. And the exotic flowers tend to sell in much smaller bottles, typically dram size. And some of these can go up into hundreds of dollars, like for example, the hydro-distilled organic rose from Bulgaria is astronomically expensive now. And also, one last one here, ylang ylang. That's hiding there at the bottom of that file. And so these are all things that are very expensive. And there's another aspect of these that's quite interesting, and that is that these are the primary oils that are used in perfumery. These oils have a special characteristic, and they have a special effect on consciousness. Now, they all have very similar qualities to the medicinal flowers, which I will unpack in a moment, but they also have a unique effect on consciousness, and that could be described as aphrodisiacal. There is an aphrodisiac intoxicating effect that comes from breathing jasmine flowers or orange blossom or rose or ylang ylang. Therefore, these could be considered more exotic in terms of their effects, and they conjure up exotic visions of the rainforest and full moon nights in the jasmine fields of South India and so forth. And so these could be called exotic for those various reasons. Now, the next category is citrus, and the citrus include the clementine and the bergamot and the grapefruits and lemon and lime and mandarin and orange and petitgrain. We'll cover these in some detail in a moment, but you can see that this represents a botanical category, and they all have very similar functions. Now, the next category contains quite a lot of oils, and this is something that we need to take quite seriously, because these are the spices, and the spice oils can be clearly correlated to the fire element, and the fire element is the most difficult element to work with in terms of avoiding dermotoxic reactions, contact dermatitis specifically, or inflammatory reactions in the mouth or the esophagus. And so the spice oils include basil and black pepper and cardamom and cinnamon and clove and fennel and ginger and marjoram, mint, oregano, peppermint, rosemary, spearmint, tulsi, and thyme. Now some of these are very, very hot and very full of fire element, cinnamon and clove, for example, or the tulsi. Some of these are actually fairly neutral, slightly warming, maybe even a little bit cooling. Fennel, cardamom, that's more in that department. So not all of these are highly dangerous or, you know, have a high risk of adverse reactions, but they're all in the spice category. Now, next category is a category that I like to call the sacred scents. And these are typically oils that come from wood and typically come from resins. And if we look at this list, what we see is that these are the woods and resins that have the longest history of use in human spiritual endeavors. And so these are linked to ceremony and ritual and prayer and gratitude and thanksgiving and meditation and contemplation and purification and so forth. Agarwood and cedar, frankincense of various types, and Palo Santo and sandalwoods of various types. So these are the species that we could classify then as those that were, that could be called sacred scents. And I'll ask a basic question when we start unpacking it. Well, why are the others not sacred? And then we can also look at the category of respiratory. Now, respiratory is not a botanical category, but it is actually a physiological anatomical category of therapeutic function. However, the primary respiratory oils mostly come from two types of trees, eucalyptus trees and conifer trees. And so therefore, we can say that to classify the eucalyptus and conifer trees, we could cross over and say that it's a respiratory category and vice versa. Therefore, we have numerous species of eucalyptus. There are numerous species of fir, the one that's listed here, silver fir. We have numerous species of juniper, two are listed here. Many species of pine and pinyon pine and a spruce and some co-distillations. So that's another botanical category. Basically, these are conifers and eucalyptus as the botanical category with the application for the respiratory system. Then finally, we come to the last group. And this group is not a botanical classification. This group are oils that we could call the unique antimicrobial oils. And this is just a way to understand a particular function of classification. And these oils could be said to be some of the most important oils for antimicrobial functions in aromatherapy. And we will be studying them, starting with tea tree today. And we have Manuka, which is also known as the lemon-scented tea tree. We have Niuli, which is a type of Melaleuca. And we have tea tree, which is Melaleuca alternifolia. And we have Ravensar. And so these do not represent one type of botanical classification, such as all the citruses or such as a specific group of flowers. This represents a therapeutic application. So this is the first file. And now what we will do is we will start to unpack the basic therapeutic properties of these botanical groupings. And so if you would look at the file now called Primary Functions of Botanical Therapeutic Categories, the Primary Functions. And what I've done here is to outline a few of the simple things that we can remember easily about all of these oils in each of these groups. And this will give us a lot of guidance in terms of the safe use, which oils we need to watch out for, which oils are relatively safe for general purposes, and so forth. And so if you will just follow along with me here, I will again go one time through this file, and then I'm going to come back and I'm going to give some additional information on each of these groups. So we start with the medicinal flowers, and the medicinal flowers, as we have just finished discussing, include chamomile, clary sage, geranium, helichrysum, lavender, and rhododendron. Those would be the most important ones. Now, what do all of these share in common? Well, first of all, they all smell somewhat similar. Now, that's a blanket statement because actually rhododendron smells quite different from chamomile, but chamomile smells different from clary sage and helichrysum smells different than all of them. But what can we say that is similar? They all have floral, sweet kind of notes. Okay, they all are relatively soft in fragrance. And so what we find then is that the flower oils do share quite a bit of olfactory characteristics as compared to one of the antimicrobials like niaouli, or one of the spices like tulsi or clove. In other words, they smell more like each other than other things. And that's because they also share a number of similar compounds. And therefore, because they share a number of similar compounds, they also have a number of similar therapeutic properties. So let's look at what these therapeutic properties are. The primary functions of the botanical category of medicinal flowers is that all of these flowers are relaxing to the mood and the mind. And we can go through and we can see that chamomile is that way, clary sage is definitely that way, lavender is famous for that, geranium is famous for that, and so forth. And so all these flowers have some degree of relaxant properties, and that is very important to just keep in mind that now you know the primary use of most of those flowers: relaxing to the mood and the mind and anti-anxiety. And that's very different than the spice oils, which tend to be very stimulant to the mood and the mind and antidepressant. So what could we say then if we were going to link this back to Module 1? We would say that these oils are more yin. The spice oils are more yang. That these oils have more moonlight and soma. The spice oils have more fire. So we can cross these over again. All right, so what do we see then in terms of aromatherapeutic application? These are oils that are used a lot for calming the nervous system and the various applications: diffusers, massage oil, bath, direct palm inhalation, a few drops on the pillow, so forth. And we also see that they are uplifting and antidepressant. They are not just calming, but they are also antidepressant because they are relaxing. And this is something very important to keep in mind about all herbs in general, and also many oils, is that they have dual functions. Okay, so you can use a flower oil in aromatherapy for treating both anxiety and depression because it not only calms the nervous system and has a yin cooling kind of relaxing effect that is anti-anxiety, but it also is nourishment for the spirit, and it also supports the spirit of the heart, what we call Shen in Chinese medicine. It's the brightness of the eyes and the ojas in Chinese medicine, the nutritional essence of the body that gives us the luminosity of the aura. So the flowers basically help to support a kind of mental well-being that includes being relaxed and emotionally and psychologically and mentally uplifted. Again, these are generally cooling and anti-inflammatory. You see lavender is used specifically for burns. Helichrysum is used for burns. Chamomile, clary sage, they're all used for cooling skin conditions. Now, what does that tell us in terms of the dermotoxic potential? And this is one of the very specific things that we would like to learn today, is that we can answer that question that comes up a lot You say don't put the oils on the skin undiluted, but what about lavender for this or that? Isn't lavender good for the skin? Isn't rose good for the skin? Well, we start with basic safety guidelines, and we say don't put the oils directly on the skin. That's because a lot of people are told, put oils on your skin. But they're not told that there's different levels of risk. And so I think that if you look at this first group, medicinal flowers, and you understand that they're cooling and anti-inflammatory, yin-yin by nature, then you are going to easily understand that they have low dermotoxic potential. And that means that there's much less risk involved in using these oils than using the spice oils, for example, or some of the antimicrobial oils like tea tree, which is very high dermotoxic potential. So therefore, these flower oils are also beneficial to the skin. And they also have anti-infectious properties that are quite significant. Like, for example, lavender, there's a file there for you to look through, and one of the things that it covers is how anti-infectious it is. It's highly beneficial for reducing colds and flus and airborne pathogens and contagion of respiratory conditions and MRSA. Antibiotic-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, amazing that a flower oil like lavender would be so effective against these microbes. Now, that's what we're going to start looking at in the next class, is the antimicrobial powers of the oils, especially in relation to the respiratory system and respiratory therapeutics. And finally, what we see in this particular list is that these oils are famous, commonly, widely used, to support female hormonal balance. And so again, we can say that these oils have a tendency to be more yin, and they have a tendency to be more relaxing and balancing. Okay, now, that should give you a good overview. So now you have a list of oils that are considered primarily medicinal. Many of these oils are also used in perfumery, but they are not considered primary perfume oils. They're sort of secondary supportive oils for perfumery. But the next group, the exotic flowers, these are the ones that are the most commonly used in perfumery. And what's the purpose of perfumery? The purpose of perfumery is to make us feel euphoric and to uplift us, and for attractant, romantic, erotic purposes, to befuddle the mind with aphrodisiacal impulses. And therefore, these particular flowers of champa and geranium with rose and jasmine and orange blossom and ylang ylang, these all have this famous reputation of having a stronger effect on consciousness. But they're also medicinal, and therefore what we can say is that they have the same overall properties as the medicinal flowers, but they have stronger mood uplifting and antidepressant effects. Therefore, if we are looking at the difference, say, between lavender and jasmine, we say jasmine is mild in terms of its mood uplifting effect, lavender is mild in terms of its mood uplifting effect, but jasmine is just outright euphoric. And if it creates euphoria, then it undoubtedly is going to help our moods. So therefore, we say that these exotic flowers have stronger mood uplifting and antidepressant effects. They are stronger relaxant and anxiolytic types of oils, and they are more sensual and aphrodisiac, and they also have a stronger effect on the female hormonal balance. So that's how we can classify different types of flowers. Now, as we continue here, we come to the citrus group, and what can we say about all the citrus oils? And there's an extensive list there that I just gave, all the different citruses. And these are mostly extracted by cold pressing the peel. Sometimes the entire fruit is centrifuged, fruit and peel, and then extracted from distillation. Most of the oil that's produced is actually a byproduct of the food industry. And the citrus oils have some very important things to consider about them. First of all, the most important thing that you should remember already from Module 1, and this is something you always should make a connection with, whenever you hear citrus oil, you should immediately think high risk. It is phototoxic. They are all phototoxic. Now, there are different degrees of phototoxicity, and there will be many questions coming about that, and I will provide some further information about that, not in this module, but coming soon, about the spectrum of phototoxicity. But one of the things that can be said very easily is that the bergamot oil is by far the most phototoxic. Do not put bergamot oil directly on your skin and go out in the sun or go to a tanning place. You'll get burned badly. And in general, most of the citrus oils are like that. However, there are some differences between whether they are cold pressed or whether they are distilled and so forth, and some differences between the species as well. So just allow me another week to put together a full chart on this for your future reference. And in the meantime, the most important thing to take away here is just don't put citrus oils directly on your skin. You can dilute them, and they can be used in the bath, and they can be used in massage oil. And the simple rule with this question always comes, well, if they're phototoxic, what about in these body care products? Or what about in the bath? What about in the massage oil? The simple rule is just use them later in the afternoon. And that way, if you do go outside, you're not going to be exposed to sunlight, and the risk is reduced. That's the easy way to do it. So basically, the effect wears off after about 8 hours or so. And if they're diluted in the bath oil, diluted in a body oil, most likely the dilution itself is going to really reduce the risk. The risk comes from people putting these oils undiluted on the skin. That's where we have to be careful. And so what are the general therapeutic functions of this category? These are mood elevating. These are gently relaxing. And these are supportive also of anti-infectious and antimicrobial oils. And so therefore, these oils are very nice to put into the diffuser along with lavender. Citrus oils mix with practically everything. And so they are also very nice to use with some of the stronger antimicrobials like tea tree. So these are a few of the basic functions. I'm going to come back and unpack these again. And also we're going to do the monographs as good examples of each of these. Then we come to the spices. Now, the spices represent a unique group of essential oils that are particularly problematic. The reason for that is because most of the spice oils, not all of them, but most of the spice oils generally have a high risk of dermatotoxic reactions, specifically contact dermatitis, inflammation on the skin. And again, from last week, I just want to reiterate that inflammation on the skin as a dermatotoxic reaction, meaning contact dermatitis, is not detoxification. That is a fraudulent, dangerous claim. Most of the spices are stimulants. They are rich in fire energy, solar energy, agni. They are yang. Therefore, they tend to be stimulant, and that means energizing to the mind. Anything that is stimulant and energizing tends to be antidepressant, right? And so therefore you see that in the herb world, stimulants are widely used to lift people up who are feeling tired and depressed. And that can be anything from just a shot of espresso to nice teas to energy drinks full of guarana. People use sugar that way also, and you can see in herbal medicine, things like mate, yerba mate, and kola nut, and things like that. And they're all classified as stimulants of the nervous system and the brain, and they do exhaust the adrenal system and so forth. But stimulation tends to lift the mind out of depressive states. The nice thing about the spice oils is that they are mildly stimulant. They are not like taking an energy drink like Monster Energy from the gas station. It's not going to give you a shocking buzz, a semi-enlightened state for a half an hour and then a big blood sugar crash. Instead, it's going to give you a mild, warming kind of stimulant effect that can be very, very pleasant and very supportive of the mood. So warming to circulation. And as we get into some of these oils now in the monographs, we're going to unpack this. and learn, well, what do you do with these oils? Because cinnamon oil is strongly, strongly dermotoxic. And generally, it is best to just not even use it. But if you are going to use it very, very carefully. And it goes nicely in warming circulatory preparations. So the spice oils are also some of the most powerful anti-infectious and antimicrobial oils. Cinnamon oil is extremely antibacterial. Clove oil, extremely antibacterial. Many, many studies going back 100 years showing that these spices will kill the microbes. Now, that's not all there is to it, because these oils kill the microbes doesn't mean that we can effectively do it in the body. It's a very complicated thing that I'm going to unpack in the next class. But these are especially helpful in atmospheric diffusing for reducing airborne contagious pathogens. The spice oils are also very nicely appetizing, and that's a wonderful thing, because one of the things that we would like to avoid is taking the spice oils internally. Now, you'll see that I just contradicted the next line I'm going to give you. Beneficial for respiratory and digestive systems together. So if I'm saying, well, if they're beneficial for the digestive system, and I just told you don't take them internally, well, then how are we going to do this? Well, there's a number of things to consider, and this is how we are going to start developing the material in this course as we go along. We start with general guidelines, and then we become more and more specific until we really know specific applications of specific oils for specific conditions. And who knows, we might even break some of our own rules, and under certain conditions, we might even put some oils undiluted on the skin. Or maybe we might even take some essential oils internally in the right way. So how are we going to do this with spices? Well, first of all, we would like to know that spices should be diluted in oil all the time for any kind of external application. But maybe some of the spice oils, if they're diluted enough, they might be massaged onto the abdomen very nicely for relaxing effects or digestive effects. But what if we don't want to do that? What if we really don't want any skin contact with these oils at all? Well, maybe what we can do is just make herbal tea. Now, when we start the therapeutic classes next week, I'm going to be giving you a few herbal suggestions as well. And so when it comes to treating the digestive system, many people say oregano oil will kill parasites. Okay, that's great. But you can't take oregano oil internally without a high risk of inflaming your intestines, which are already inflamed. You're treating fire with fire. So what are you going to do then? Well, maybe these kind of culinary herbs, oregano and thyme and holy basil, peppermint, ginger, things like that, maybe these can be used effectively in tea form. And therefore, you are getting the essential oils in a biocompatible form that is not going to carry the risk of burning your esophagus and causing permanent damage. So this is one of the ways that we will unpack how to get around some of these problems with the stronger, potentially toxic oils. And then also, we will learn that if you put these spice oils on a perfume strip and you smell them, that they will stimulate your appetite. That's because they are appetizing. And what I have seen all the time in many, many presentations with large groups of people is it is always best to use these oils at two different times of day. One is to smell them before lunch, because what happens? When you smell oregano oil, everybody starts to think about pizza. And everybody starts to get hungry. In other words, smelling these spices stimulates the appetite. And that's a really good time to do it, because then people can run out and they can eat and they'll have a great appetite. But sometimes it doesn't always work out in the presentation that that's how it works. And so what's another good time to use these? After lunch, when people come back and it's warm in the room and people have just had a heavy meal and they're starting to fall asleep. Well, this is also a good time to pass around oregano and thyme and cinnamon and clove and so forth, because they are stimulant and they will keep people's mental energy up. So how do we use this? Well, there's a special application of this group of oils, and you can go ahead and you can start doing this now safely if you have these oils and you have some perfume strips and you know somebody who has anorexia, low appetite, losing their appetite, nausea. Maybe it's somebody who's going through chemotherapy and radiation, and I'm not going to tell you that you can treat cancer, but what I'm going to tell you is that you can put the spice oils on a perfume strip and give it to somebody who is feeling nauseous, and if they smell it, it will settle their stomach and stimulate their appetite. And so this is good for elderly people, because as we get older, our sense of smell goes down, and as our sense of smell goes down, our appetite, our sense of taste goes down, and therefore our appetite frequently goes down. And so a lot of times elderly people don't have much of an appetite because they have weakness of the taste and smell senses. Therefore, smelling the spices can activate the appetite. All right, so that's a brief overview. Now we come to the sacred scents. And what do we see here? These are... let me just review what we're talking about here again. We're talking specifically about agarwood, which is a whole subject in itself, cedarwood oil, frankincense oils, Palo Santo, and sandalwood. Now, what do these all have in common? Well, first of all, these are the oils that come from substances that have been used the most through human history for spiritual purposes. So we could call these the sacred scents. Now, the sacred scents, both the essential oils and the woods and the resins burned directly as offerings to the coal and the fire and so forth, all of these things have a very strong beneficial effect on the mind and the nervous system. And basically what we can say is that they are mood elevating and that they are also calming. They have a dual function of calming, relaxing the mind, the emotions, and lifting up the spirit. So therefore, if we were to translate those two terms of calming the mind and lifting the spirit into modern psychiatric language, we would say that these oils are antidepressant and anti-anxiety. And so that is what we would like for treating all kinds of emotional disturbances and mental suffering. We would like to have antidepressant and mood uplifting, spirit uplifting effects. And these effects are directly applicable and very beneficial for supporting meditation and contemplation. One of the most obvious common obstacles to meditation is when people sit down to meditate, they have a lot of tension in the body from everything they've been doing. They've been running around. They've got a lot of things happening. Nervous system's overstimulated. They haven't sat down to be quiet and be peaceful for quite a while, and so the body's agitated. And then gradually what happens as people start to relax is that the mind becomes tired. It actually starts, the body starts to recognize how tired it actually is. And so people fall asleep. And these are the two major obstacles to meditation practice, is being overly agitated and being fatigued. Now, it's really nice to use these oils for that particular purpose. You can just put a frankincense tear, a little piece of frankincense resin, directly on a coal. And it's a nice ritual to do. You just slow down, light the coal, put it on the incense burner, put the piece of frankincense on the coal, and it makes a beautiful little wafting trail of smoke. And it perfumes your meditation room. And that fragrance goes into your limbic system and you start to relax. Therefore, the transition from being busy into being more meditative becomes a lot easier. So this is a very simple practical application. But again, I'm going to come back and unpack this as we go through the monographs and look at the oils in detail. So what we can say then is that these are supportive to meditation, but these are also significantly anti-infectious and antimicrobial, especially the frankincense and the Palo Santo as well. These two are renowned in the traditional cultures that they come from of protecting against evil spirits, meaning contagion, and protecting against bad vapors, bad smells, And bad smells are generally caused by putrefaction in bacteria, which carry pathogenic microbes. And so anything that has a protective, purifying effect in the atmosphere probably can be translated as something that is antimicrobial at some level. Now, these are also very good for supporting the respiratory system, especially frankincense. Again, in Palo Santo as well. We'll go through these in detail, but I just wanted to give you the brief overview first. And these are very good for the mind and the nervous system. Okay, so those are the main things. Now, what about the dermotoxic potential? Well, that really depends. Now, here in this particular category, we don't have one rule. Okay, flowers, we can say, are all low dermotoxic potential. Citrus, we can say, are all high phototoxic potential. Spices, we can say, are all high thermotoxic potential, but these are all variable. For example, agarwood oil is distilled. It's extremely expensive. As a matter of fact, it is the most expensive oil on the market, and most of it is contaminated. You cannot find the real thing. It goes through approximately 10 hands between the time it leaves the distiller and it reaches the market, and everybody stretches it with all kinds of additives and so forth. But if you are lucky enough to get it, in its pure form, it's going to cost you hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a very small amount. A 1 dram bottle can run between $500 and $1,000 for real, true, pure agarwood oil. That oil itself, low dermotoxic potential. As a matter of fact, it's good for the skin. Same for sandalwood oil. Sandalwood oil is actually an oil that is really good for the skin. It's very thick, it's viscous, it's soft, it's not spicy, it's very yin, it's very full of ojas, as we talked about in Module 1. It's a lunar kind of influence. And so sandalwood is actually low dermotoxic potential, agarwood is low dermotoxic potential, but Palo Santo can burn. Okay, Palo Santo can, if you put too much in the bath and get in, you can get burned. If you put too much directly on the skin, you can get burned. And so dilute it or just use it in the diffuser. Frankincense is sort of in between. In general, frankincense has low dermotoxic potential if you have true frankincense oil. Unfortunately, frankincense oil, again, highly adulterated. One of the unpleasant statistics that I have heard from the industry experts, 90% of frankincense oil is adulterated. And so therefore, the concern with frankincense oil is not necessarily the oil itself, using it on the skin, or maybe even taking it internally. It's the adulterants that are in the oil that are really, really problematic. And so that's how we would break that down in terms of the spectrum. There's nothing that's really high dermotoxic potential here. Palo Santo is the highest, but it's not really high like some things like the citruses. Now let's look at the respiratory oils in terms of therapeutic functions. These all have low dermotoxic potential. Eucalyptus oil is very safe. You can put many, many drops on your palms and you can get in the shower, rub it on your chest. It's fine. Same with the conifer oils, low dermotoxic potential. But I will add one more point to that statement, and that is, if something is low dermotoxic potential, it does not mean that it does not have the ability to sometimes cause adverse reactions for some people. Now, the majority of times that I have seen, this is really due to the contaminants in the oil. And so now we're hearing a lot of stories about a low dermotoxic potential, such as lavender, which is supposedly very, very safe for everybody to put directly on the skin, but more and more people are getting really bad reactions from it. Or helichrysum, things that are very generally considered safe. But what we now know is that lavender oil is highly adulterated. The demand is so huge and the production and source of the high quality oil is actually somewhat limited. And the statistic now is approximately 60% of lavender oil is adulterated with something or another. And therefore, I believe that a lot of the dermotoxic reactions that are happening are coming because oils that were previously not dermotoxic are now contaminated with something that is. And that could be a different species of lavender, a Some species of lavender have high camphor content and they can burn the skin. Or it could be that some broker bought this huge amount of lavender oil and put it into storage for a few years and it oxidized. And the oxidation can cause the problems. And so I can say eucalyptus oils and conifer oils are low dermatoxic potential. They're not going to hurt you if you rub them on your chest. But at the same time, there may be somebody who has a sensitivity to eucalyptus, and they shouldn't do that. Okay, so this is all, these are all general rules. These are all general evaluations of the risks involved of these oils, but please approach these oils carefully, slowly, whenever you're trying something new. If you're bringing a new oil into your life, don't just pour it all over yourself. Approach it very, very slowly, respectfully, and see how it feels. So the respiratory oils are all expectorant and decongestant and antitussive. Okay, so expectorant basically means that it helps to loosen up the phlegm in the chest to cough it out, and decongestant means that it's very, very good for opening and cleansing the sinuses of mucus, and antitussive mean that they can help reduce cough. Now, we're going to start making some blends in the next class, in the next two classes on the therapeutic applications for respiratory purposes, but we're going to be seeing that the eucalyptus oils and the conifer oils are always central. They're always primary. These would be the chief herbs, if we were to use the traditional Chinese medicine herbal formulating language. Now, here's a new term for you, although I believe I may have used it a few times already, and that is tridoshic. It's good for all your doshas, your body type. So therefore, vata, pitta, and kapha people can all use these oils for their respiratory problems. And so what does that mean? It means that these oils are expectorant for phlegm. They clean the lungs of phlegm. They decongest the sinuses of mucus. Well, phlegm and mucus is kapha congestion. Okay, so the expectorant part means that it's good for the kapha, the phlegmatic problems. Pitta means the inflammation. So if you breathe eucalyptus oil, it's very cooling to your respiratory inflammation from the infection. Okay, so it's cooling to the inflammation. And then especially if you use it with steam inhalation, which is moistening, then these oils are also very good for vata, meaning dryness. Okay, so another primary function of this group, antimicrobial, anti-infectious, and that means purifying, as I've said before. So these are the main oils that you want to use in a diffuser to purify the atmosphere and reduce the risk of airborne pathogens. These also are uplifting to the mind, because anything that helps to clear your sinuses and enhance the flow of oxygen into your respiratory system is going to increase the amount of prana and chi. Because prana and chi is closely related to the breath and closely related to the respiratory system. And so therefore, if the respiratory system is congested, prana and chi are blocked. And prana and chi go directly to the brain. They nourish the brain. And therefore, if we have chronic sinus congestion, we wake up every morning with chronic sinus congestion from allergies. We also have brain fog and mental dullness. These oils are very rich in air element. All right, so the flower oils, we can say, are very rich in moonlight. And the spice oils, we can say, are very rich in sunlight. These oils are very rich in air element, and therefore they open respiratory system, they support respiratory system, increase oxygenation, therefore they enhance the intake of prana and chi, therefore they give us mental clarity. Now these oils are also used extensively, as we will learn, for musculoskeletal issues. They're not just good for the mind, and they're not just good for the respiratory system, but they're also very good in massage preparations for stiffness of the joints, inflammation of the joints, stiff muscles, and so forth. And so you often see eucalyptus oil or some of the compounds extracted from the eucalyptus oils in liniments. and salves and tinctures and poultices and so forth for the musculoskeletal system. All right. Finally, our last group here, the unique antimicrobials. And again, just to review, a few of the primary species that I am familiar with and I like to use: Manuka oil, lemon scented tea tree, Naya auli, Ravensar, and tea tree. And we're going to switch our conversation here in just a moment, and we're going to look at the monographs, and we're going to start to unpack all of these oils in some detail. Now, these all come from a variety of botanical sources, so it's not really a true botanical classification. This is a therapeutic classification, but because they come from different botanical sources, they have more diversity of compounds. And because they have more diversity of compounds, they smell very different. Now, they do share some common olfactory characteristics and some common compounds, but there's also quite a bit of diversity here, and therefore it means that there is quite a bit of diversity of dermotoxic potential. And so, for example, the tea tree oil has high dermotoxic potential. Tea tree can burn the skin. It doesn't for everybody. It seems to be related also to the age of the oil and problems of oxidation. But in general, the Nayuli and the Manuka oils tend to be lower dermotoxic potential than the Ravensar and the tea tree. Now, the thing that these oils all share in common is that they have significant anti-infectious and antimicrobial powers. Now, all essential oils do. That's because, as you will remember from Module 1, the reason that plants produce essential oils is as part of their immune system. And so this is to protect them from all kinds of things, including the microbes. So one of the basic functions, botanically, of creating essential oils is immunological, and one of the ways that it works is antimicrobially. Therefore, we can say that all essential oils probably have some kind of antimicrobial power, even if it hasn't been fully documented yet. But there's so much research about the antimicrobial powers of essential oils that is something that almost everybody in the aromatherapy world agrees on, and in science agrees on also, is that essential oils are significantly antimicrobial. But these are some that are even more antimicrobial. All right, now I'm going to pause. I've been going fairly quickly. There is still a lot to say about each of these categories, but I would like to move into the monograph so that you can actually start doing these, using these oils. And before I transition over here, I just want to bring attention to a file. We're not going to actually spend any time on this. I just want to introduce it to you. And that's the file called Lavender Studies. And this is a compilation of various types of medical studies, research studies, that have been done all on lavender oil. And there's 23 pages of it, which is why we're not going to cover it in detail. This is a little homework assignment for you. Now, there's several things that are here for you to note. First of all, the studies are organized according to major functions. And so you're going to see that there are many studies about the antimicrobial effects. But you're also going to see that there's other categories as well, and that has to do with the effects emotionally and anti-anxiety, mood uplifting, and so forth. And so these are classified according to different therapeutic benefits. Okay, effects on relaxation, psychological effects in healthy postpartum mothers, anxiety and self-esteem in the elderly, post-operative pain, controlling anxiety. So you'll see that there are many, many studies, and they're organized according to different types of functions. That tells us that lavender oil has a lot of different functions. Another thing that you will find intriguing about this, and I have added my commentary, okay? I've put my commentary in here. One of the things that you're going to see is that these studies are really dense. They will introduce you to the kind of literature that's there in the medical world about what research is happening. And so a lot of the language here is really, really scientific, specialized terms and so forth. And what I've done is I've highlighted very specific sentences for you to make the reading a little bit easier. And then I've interjected my own commentary, such as, here we find confirmation that lavender is effective against MRSA. We also learn that combinations of different species of the same oil may enhance its effects. This is the principle behind blending eucalyptus and helichrysum, etc. Okay, so you're going to see the studies. You're going to see certain things highlighted in the studies. You're going to see the studies organized according to basic functions, and you're going to see my commentary on it. I invite you to spend some time enjoying what the medical research community is coming out with, because it's quite intriguing, and you're going to learn quite a lot about how they do these studies and what they're finding. And sometimes these things are obviously biased, and sometimes they're even fraudulent, and sometimes these studies are used for political purposes to give bad press to natural medicine, and usually gets a lot of attention when they do that. For example, lavender several years ago got a lot of press because there was a study that was later debunked that said that lavender oil in shampoo is giving boys gynecomastia. In other words, it's causing boys to grow breasts. Well, of course, that created a panic. And I had many, many, many comments, questions coming about that. And I just responded and said, well, if that's true, all the men in the south of France should have breasts by now because they are swimming in lavender oil and they've been doing that for generations. And then I also pointed out that if that were true, somebody probably would have figured out a way to put this to advantage and make a lot of money from breast enhancement preparations. But it doesn't do that, and it was debunked. Okay, so this is for your pleasure and enjoyment. Learn a little bit of scientific language. Now, before we go into the monographs on the specific oils, which cover a lot of information in detail about what you can do now with one oil from each of these botanical groupings, this will give you quite a lot to work with for the next week. Actually, 2 weeks, since we are not having class next week, just a reminder. I would like to just pause for a moment and open it up, since it's a transition, and see if anybody has any questions or comments so far about what I have covered. And so, Colleen, I'm going to turn it back to you and see if there's anything specifically related to this discussion about these botanical categories. Now, keep in mind, we never have enough time for all the webcast questions, but what I will be doing is, as we go along, I'm going to start posting a file for all the webcast questions that come in. I will answer them. Anything you write, any questions you ask, or any comments, it will be taken in. I will read it. I will respond. It's just that we generally don't have time on the call itself. But we can take a few minutes now, very shortly, and do a few oils in the monographs, and then do a few more, a couple more minutes at the end. So, Colleen, do you want to see if anybody would like to raise their hand?
Yes, please. To raise your hand, press 1 if you're on the telephone. And on the webcast, of course, David has seen that there are many questions already. And as we're waiting for those to raise their hand on the Maestro system, we'll start with a question from Shivani. What is the difference between sniffing an essential oil on a perfume strip and sniffing right from the bottle? Is it something that's beyond convenience and being able to use blends?
Yes. excuse me. A perfume strip is the professional way of doing it. And there's a reason for that, and that is because if you smell directly from the bottle, first of all, it's not going to open itself up. If you put the oil on your skin, it will open up and you will be able to smell it. Many more dimensions to all the notes will be there, but it's also going to mix with the chemicals in your skin, and so it's not going to be the true fragrance. So perfumers and aromatherapists use perfume strips, and what that does, you put a few drops on a blotter paper, and then you breathe it. And because it's on the blotter paper, it is evaporating a cloud of molecules into the air, and you breathe those in. Therefore, the oil, the perfume, the fragrance opens itself up fully for exploration. And it's not just that. It's also that it changes as it dries out. And so in perfume language, and this is something we'll study shortly, every oil, every fragrance has a top note, middle note, and base note. And oils can be classified that way as well. And so, for example, many of the roots and woods are base notes. They're heavier. Many of the flowers are middle notes. And many of the conifer and eucalyptus are top notes. In other words, top notes are very light and they evaporate quickly. Middle notes are a bit heavier and they evaporate more slowly, and base notes are very heavy and they can stay there for a very long time. Like, for example, patchouli is considered the ultimate fixative base note, because if you spilled it in your VW van 50 years ago, it's still there. So oils evaporate at different rates, and you cannot perceive that if the oil stays in the bottle. So therefore, if you put it on the perfume strip, the benefit is that it opens up and you are able to smell a full range of various aromas and all of its notes, and you can do it in a contemplative way, and you will notice that it changes, and you can come back to it after 5 minutes, after 15 minutes, after half an hour, after an hour, after 3 hours, the next day, the next week, the next month, and you can see how the entire fragrance is unfolding. So that's why we use perfume strips. Also, you can do blending on perfume strips, and that's a nice convenient way to just do a preliminary blend, is you can put a drop of eucalyptus and then a drop of lavender, and you can just see how they smell together. But of course, you don't want to do that in the bottle. You don't want to add them to each other until you have a general sense. And then you want to mix them in a separate bottle. So we're going to be covering all of that as we go along also. Good question. Okay. Let's do one more quickly and then jump into some monographs.
Okay. This is from Gaia, and she's having a question. What about all the many other oils that are not listed on your documentation? How do we go to figure out the category on our own? Like, for an example, I have corn mint. How do I go about figuring out its classification? Any idea?
Why don't we start with this extensive list first? This is quite a bit to study already. If you have others that you would like to classify, then I suggest that you think of it in terms of what is it close to. And so I would ask, and I would say, well, corn mint. Does it have a mint fragrance? Well, in that particular case, you could probably classify it similar to peppermint or spearmint. Okay, and all the mints have a tendency to be in the same classification. But now the question comes, are mints actually true spices, or are they something else? Are they cooling or are they heating? Well, that's a little bit of a conundrum in terms of classification, in terms of the five elements, in terms of yin and yang. There's many oils, and this is what I mentioned in the first module, there are many oils that are difficult to put into a box. If it's easy to put them into a box, it's real clear, it can be helpful. But there are many things that are difficult to classify. And this is an ongoing process, and so I would suggest that if you have other oils, and this is not the comprehensive list either of what we're going to be studying, and that might be helpful to know that these are only the primary examples of these primary botanical categories, and as we go, you're going to be introduced to many, many other oils. There is a file that came, I believe it was either last week or the week before, a full oil list, a full list of all the oils we will be covering. And even that's not everything, because there's going to be other things that are going to pop up in recipes and blends and so forth. So this is just one list of very important oils to start with in terms of classifications. And so therefore, let's say the respiratory oils. How many species of fir? How many species of spruce? How many eucalyptus species are there? Well, if you add all those up, there's There's something like 700 species of eucalyptus, and there's dozens and dozens of species of spruce and dozens of pine and so forth. And so you may have oils that are already classified. They're not the exact species that are on this list, but they're already pretty close because they're a conifer or they're a eucalyptus. So that would be the starting point. Just think about, what is it closest to? Is it a flower oil? Is it a spice oil? It's probably fairly easy to bring things into the general classifications. And don't worry about it also. You can go back to Module 1 because you can also use that system of classification. But keep in mind that as we go, there's going to be a lot of recipes, a lot of formulas, a lot of blends, a lot of therapeutic applications, and many, many more oils are going to be introduced. And some oils, it doesn't even really matter if we classify them because they have a specific purpose, okay? They have a specific benefit. And so I put helichrysum under the medicinal flowers. That's one way to do it. We could classify it according to its chemistry. But it's difficult to put it into a lot of different categories easily. And so in that case, helichrysum is really best classified by itself according to its therapeutic application, which is it's the number one wound healing herb, number one wound healing oil, okay, excellent for the skin. And so it's in a class by itself, really. And so that's the bigger answer, is that if we can't figure out how to classify it, just put it in the category of its therapeutic application. Okay, I hope that was helpful. Now let's move on. And if you would please open the file called Monographs for Module 3. Now I'm just going to start
David,
this. Yes, please.
Just if you could repeat any file that you open, please, just twice,
yes,
for everyone. Thank you.
Yes, sorry. That would be the file called Monographs for Module 3. Oil Monographs for Module 3. And I am just going to start off by showing you how these monographs work. And this will be a little homework for you. Read through all of these. And then you'll start to get a sense of how the information is organized and compiled. And this is how you're going to get a huge amount of information about each species of oil for the next 6 months. The monographs in this file are bergamot, clove, eucalyptus, frankincense, lavender, and tea tree. And I did not put specific species of eucalyptus, frankincense, or lavender because there's a number of variables with that, okay, many different possibilities. But the information is found more specifically as we scroll down. And each of these oils represents one example of each of the botanical classifications that we did. So you just learned broad categories of therapeutic applications according to botany, and now we can look at one example of a citrus, one example of a spice, one example of a respiratory oil, one example of a sacred scent, one example of a medicinal flower, and one example of a unique antimicrobial. Let's just go ahead. Let's see here. We're probably going to be running out of time here soon. Why don't we look at eucalyptus, for example? So now if you would scroll down, to the page, starting with eucalyptus, and you will see that this now gives the specific Latin botanical name, Eucalyptus globulus. Well, a question is going to come. How interchangeable are the different eucalyptus oils? Well, they are relatively interchangeable, but they all have some unique characteristics. And so what I'm going to say here, what I'm going to say here is that there are two species that are relevant for almost all this material in this monograph, but this monograph is also relevant for almost all the eucalyptus species, but there are some species that are somewhat different, and so let's just say that this monograph is really specifically about Eucalyptus globulus and Eucalyptus radiata. okay, radiata. Now, don't worry about these terms. You're going to hear these over and over, especially when we get into the next module on the respiratory conditions. We're going to be unpacking the differences and similarities between a lot of the conifer and the eucalyptus species. So the way that these monographs work is that first you get an overview. And so what you see here is that it's a large tree. And for those of you who have been in the medicinal plants course, you're quite familiar with this. We did this with all the different herbs. Now we're doing this with the essential oils. And so it's a large tree, and it's native to various parts of the world. There's over 700 species. And here's another list of some of the common ones, Globulus, Smithii, Polybracta, Radiata. There's the term Radiata. These are the ones that are used primarily for medicinal purposes for cooling and tonic effects, okay? Other species, Citriodara, that's the lemon-scented eucalyptus. MacArthurii, that's a nice one I'm familiar with. That's a rose-scented eucalyptus, which is used a lot in the perfume industry. And the Eucalyptus globulus has the common name of blue gum. You might hear it referred to that way. So these monographs will also give you quite a bit of detail about common name, botanical name, and so forth. And the last sentence, known for its strong medicinal qualities, the blue gum, or the globulus, has an affinity for the respiratory tract and supporting a healthy inflammatory response in most of the body systems. And like I mentioned, eucalyptus is also used for musculoskeletal problems, and that's because it is anti-inflammatory. Now, the next section that we come to, therapeutic actions and benefits. It's tonic. What does that mean? It means that basically it has a bracing, stimulant, awakening, energizing kind of effect, okay? It's refreshing. It's stimulant to the senses and energetic channels of body and mind. And it has eucalyptol. Now, in these monographs, you will learn some chemistry. I'm not going to dwell on it a lot, but it's really good to know that eucalyptus oil has a primary active ingredient, which is called eucalyptol. And that active ingredient has anti-inflammatory, analgesic, antibacterial, antifungal, anti-this, anti-that, lots of properties. Expectorant, decongestant. It has an affinity for the respiratory system, and it fights respiratory infections, colds, and flus. It helps speed up recovery and promoting of good respiratory health. It boosts the immune system by decongesting the airways and allows the lungs to enhance the oxygen intake. Now, this is established from two primary traditions of information. The first tradition is the historical use of the plant itself in ethnobotany. And so what is known is that the eucalyptus leaves have been used probably tens of thousands of years by the Aboriginal people of Australia. Now, if a plant is used for that long, it has undoubtedly a medicinal value. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother using it over and over again. And if it has a medicinal value, then it probably has an active primary ingredient or a very important synergistic set of compounds. Now, in the case of eucalyptus, one of the primary ingredients is eucalyptol. And so eucalyptol becomes concentrated then during the steam distillation process into the essential oil. And the active ingredient of the leaves is the essential oil, basically. And that's what comes out in the sweat lodge and rubbing it on the skin and burning it and making tea from it and so forth. All the traditional ethnobotanical uses were basically just using the essential oil from the leaves in whole plant form. Now, the other major source of information is from the modern research into essential oils, and that includes both the empirical evidence of aromatherapy as well as the scientific documentation. And so when we get into the respiratory modules, there's going to be some nice studies about the actual antimicrobial powers of these oils. And there's some information on this monograph about that as well. We're going to be really learning about, okay, this is what modern science knows. So basically, that's where this information comes from. How do we know that eucalyptus does this? Well, we know because Aboriginal people use eucalyptus leaves for thousands of years. It's the essential oil that's doing it. And here's the essential oil and how long have people been using essential the essential oil of eucalyptus. Well, it probably goes back, I don't remember, it might even be in this monograph, but I think it's about 100 years or so ago that they started distilling eucalyptus oil. So there's quite a number of decades of use of the oil, as well as the modern research, and a lot of research now, many, many studies. So those are the sources of information. So again, we continue on here and we see that eucalyptus supports cerebral circulation. Well, what does that mean? We always want to think about, okay, what direction is this particular herb or this particular oil going to move our physiology? And so what we see then is that it supports cerebral circulation. Well, it opens the sinuses. That makes perfect sense. And so anything that's going to stimulate cerebral circulation is also going to help clarify our mind and our concentration. It's also good for peripheral circulation. That means that it's good in massage oil for promoting muscle and joint health, protecting the skin from bacterial and fungal infections, and so on. So it has a tonic and stimulating effect on the mind. And the word tonic here means that it tones it. It sharpens it, okay? It enhances concentration, clears our thoughts. And now we get into a very interesting aspect of aromatherapy, which is very subjective, and that is that there's a lot of discussion about what oils do emotionally and energetically and spiritually. Now, I don't have any problem with this. I think it's fine, but I just want to point out that when we start talking about the emotional impacts of the oils, and this is going to be a theme throughout the entire course, when we're talking about the emotional impacts or the spiritual impacts or the energetic effects, it is a very subjective interpretation. All right, and some people may feel something very strongly, and another person may not feel anything at all. And one person may say that it feels like this, and another person may say that it feels like that. And to make things even more complicated, somebody who says that it opens the heart may be talking about something entirely different than another person who says it opens the heart. And none of them are talking about anything that a cardiac surgeon would understand. They're talking about something that's very subtle and very personalized and very energetic and very subjective. And so I just want to bring that to our attention as a little warning about the difficulty of talking about essential oils at the emotional level. But emotionally, it is associated with alleviating grief and sorrow. Well, why is that? It tonifies the brain. It lifts our spirits, okay? Opening the heart and equalizing the emotions, all right? Well, these are all good things to state about it, but whether it does that in a specific way for everybody is somewhat open to interpretation. All right. Now, the next part of every monograph is going to be the list of specific therapeutic actions. Now, sometimes some of these may be a little contradictory, and sometimes there's just this huge amount of information, and you're going to wonder, well, out of all of this information, what do I do? What is the most important? And that is my role here, is to tell you the most important things. And the most important things as we go through here, respiratory, circulatory, immune, musculoskeletal, nervous, skin, and energetic, meaning in aromatherapy for uplifting, clearing negative emotions, stimulating the mind, and all of that. What I would say eucalyptus oil is the best for is the respiratory functions. Number one, alleviates chronic and acute bronchitis, sinusitis, asthma, sore throat, infections, laryngitis, clears the head, unclogs the sinuses, all of those things. That's the number one. The number two most important function is immune, and that's why you want to put it in your diffuser, because it's going to purify the atmosphere, strengthen your immune system during the winter cold and flu season. After that, I would say that depending on how you want to use it, that it could either go into the musculoskeletal department or helping to relieve headaches and so forth by clearing the mind. Those are the ways that I would classify it. I would say circulatory, yes, but a very secondary. Okay, skin, yes, but very secondary. So respiratory and immune system, really most important. That's how I would classify it. Okay, so a little information will always come in these monographs about what does Ayurveda say, what does Chinese medicine say. And now we come to the aromatic profile. And this is important because this is where we're going to start to learn the language of the oils. And this will be something that we're going to get into quite a bit when we start to make some blends. And every oil, we should also be able to understand it. And this is where you can do some very enjoyable homework, and that is to do the contemplative aromatherapy, as I have described, but instead of trying to identify whether an oil belongs to a certain element of earth, water, fire, air, space, or something like that, now try to identify the aromatic profile. And so if you have Eucalyptus globulus or Eucalyptus radiata, you can put a few drops on a perfume strip and you can breathe it slowly and notice what's called camphoraceous. Notice what's called clear and minty or menthol. As the top note evaporates a little bit, you will start to notice what's called herbaceous. Okay, herbaceous is also known as green, and herbaceous is very similar to vegetative. So you can actually start to smell the leafy material in the oil. There's a little bit of spice in there, not much. Some oils are spicier than others. Some eucalyptus spicier than others. Then, as it evaporates more and gets into the base note, you're going to start noticing that you can actually smell the presence of the resinous qualities. And that means also a little bit of the woody undertone. And there's also sweetness, especially in the radiata. The globulus is much more camphoraceous, and the radiata is much more sweet. Now, in terms of classifying top, middle, and base, this is also where you're going to get this information. This is a top note. In other words, it's light, and it evaporates quickly as opposed to being a heavy note that stays around on the perfume strip for a long time. You'll notice that the eucalyptus is basically gone within 24 hours. Now, what can you blend it with? You can blend it with practically everything. All oils can blend with practically everything else. It's just a matter of proportions that really make the difference. We will unpack that as we go into future modules. But here's a few simple suggestions. Thyme, rosemary, marjoram, and so forth. Now, safety. This, of course, we already know because we studied the botanical classification. We know that the eucalyptus oils are low dermotoxic. And so this is said quite clearly here, non-toxic, non-irritating. But again, keep in mind, you might be a person who gets irritated by eucalyptus oil. Now, in the next module, we're going to get into some of the complications about eucalyptus for asthma. Is it good for asthma? Well, yes, but maybe not. And so there are some considerations that we have to consider, and then lots of questions will come. Is eucalyptus okay for a young child? Well, probably not. Is it okay for a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old? Well, the older they get, the safer it's going to get. We're going to cover all of those questions. We have a whole module dedicated to how to use essential oils for kids. So let's just keep that in mind. And we're going to cover all of it, okay? All of these things and using essential oils and the respiratory oils. Very important application for children, but we do have some considerations. We'll talk a little bit about it in the next module. We'll talk a lot more about it in the module for kids. Now, how do you use it? Topically, okay, so topically you can put a couple drops on your palms and just breathe it. You can put it on a hot, wet towel and you can use that as a compress. You can put a couple drops in the bath. Now, keep in mind, you already have this information from last week, the safe uses. Don't pour a whole ounce of eucalyptus on the bath. It's just going to float on the top, okay? Maximum 5 drops. Even less is probably preferable, or put it in something to emulsify it or disperse it, like the milk or the salt or something like that. So a few more recipes here, direct inhalation diffuser, and then it's going to give you some recipes for massage, 3 to 6 drops and a 1/2 ounce carrier oil for a chest rub to open the respiratory system, 1 to 2% eucalyptus in a carrier oil for local massage to enhance circulation, muscular and joint pain. You can put this in a spray bottle with a little water. You can freshen the air. You can just do direct palm inhalation to open the sinuses. It's very simple. Just carry a bottle with you. And a few drops of water in the diffuser also. A few drops in the water or diffuser for repelling insects. So a few recipes here also. All right. Let's look at these recipes before we close this section. Respiratory support. Okay, you know about using essential oils in the steam. Just put a few drops on a pot of hot water, cover your head with a towel, and breathe it. But keep your eyes closed so you don't burn yourself. So the mixture here, this is a very nice, simple recipe. There's countless recipes you can just make up. 4 drops eucalyptus, 2 drops chamomile, 4 drops silver fir. Okay, well, that's half and half, basically, of two of the respiratory oils with a little bit of cooling anti-inflammatory flower oil in with it. So just good for opening the lungs. Decongestant, expectorant, eucalyptus, cedar, frankincense, juniper berry. Same basic application, insect repellent. You can just spray this around mixed in water. Okay, now you'll notice that the concentrations are much higher here, and that's because you are mixing it with water and spraying it. All right, so that's a brief introduction to the monographs, and I think because of time, we should probably open it up for some further discussion, but I'm going to suggest read the monographs in detail, and what we'll do when we start the next class is cover the rest of these. And what you're going to see here is that these are representative of each of the botanical categories that I opened the class with, and you're going to see that therefore there's a wide range of dermotoxic potential, there's a wide range of applications, and there's a wide range of uses for moving the body physiologically in a particular direction. So eucalyptus, you now have a pretty good sense. It's working on our respiratory system. It's working on clearing the prana of the lungs and the mind. Well, frankincense is going to work in a very different way. Lavender is going to work in a very different way. So these are representative of these larger groups therapeutically. Okay, let's pause and let's open it up again. And so, Colleen, I'll turn it back to you and see if anybody would like to raise their hand for any discussion or any further comments on the webcast.
Yes, thank you so, so much, David, with so much information. I just wanted to let everyone know, please press 1 to raise your hand for a question. And if you're on the webcast, please type it directly into the box provided. And also, David, often you've been asking for examples, so I did just want to share on the course community group. There have been a few participants that are sharing their experiences in a learning way that they've had with essential oils where they've hurt, you know, they've been hurt in some
way.
Well,
if we don't have anybody else calling in with anything related right now to the topic, I think that might be a good topic to just remind everybody. So if you want to take a few minutes and share a few of those comments, that would be fine.
I do, and I must also share, David, that we do have a lot of comments on the webcast, and also now I see we have participants with their hands up. So which
okay.
would you prefer?
Let's just go back and forth. Oh, why don't we do this? Let's take the calls. And
yes.
I will answer all the webcast questions on a file to be posted at the next module because I can easily answer everybody's webcast questions that way. And as long as people are calling in, let's go ahead and do that. And if we answer everybody's question here very quickly, then we can also look at the webcast as well.
Wonderful. Okay, so here we have a caller, Nancy. Nancy, you have the mic. Go ahead, please.
I'd like to ask about wound care. If there was surgery, are you waiting until it's like the incision is totally closed to start to use essential oils?
Well, this depends on the relationship you have with the doctor. You have to remember that whenever you bring natural medicine into a clinic situation or a hospital situation that it's political in nature. And it depends on the seriousness of the condition, and it depends on whether the person is still in the hospital or whether they're discharged. So if it's, in general, if the person is discharged and there's everything is relatively stable, then you can start, okay? But I want to remind you that this is not a course on how you can treat medical things, all right? That's one of the first things that I said in the discussion last week, okay? Don't try to practice medicine without a license, okay? Now, if it's for yourself, that's totally different. And if you just came back and you have sutures and everything is stable, you could start to apply a couple of essential oils quite safely, in my opinion, and the two primary essential oils that are widely advised for fresh wounds are helichrysum and frankincense. And, you know, I've heard countless testimonials of especially the helichrysum, and we are going to get into this. We do have a module dedicated to skin care and musculoskeletal problems and so forth. But the short answer is, if you are treating yourself and everything is stable, you can start doing it relatively soon. If it is an open wound that requires medical care, well, that's kind of in the realm of emergency folk medicine. I can't really advise you to do something. I just advise you to go to the emergency room and get it treated. But if it's already treated, it's already sutured up, everything is okay, there's no infection, there's no complications, you feel like you can bring in folk medicine, yes, fine. It's you can put those oils on. Always start with a very small amount, and always remember that the political issue is that if there are any complications, natural medicine tends to be blamed, whether it is true or not. Okay, now, if you put an oil on and it's not the right oil, you get a bad reaction, well, that's a little bit complicated, because then you don't even really know. Is it the oil that's doing it, or is it really a problem with the wound itself? I mean, that's where it's politically a little bit difficult. But what I can say, just trying to be politically correct about all of this, don't try to treat other people medically. If it's yourself, you can start with helichrysum, all right? Just a small amount, just very, very small amount. You can put it directly on, and if it feels comfortable, just, you know, start slowly, see how it feels. And the general rule is the more the wound is healed up, the safer it will become to put the oils on it. And once it's all past the medical stage, okay, if you get the sutures out, everything is okay, inflammation, infection are okay, then you can go 100% into self-treatment using aromatherapy, and there won't be any problems, okay? It will just basically speed up the healing process of skin regeneration, skin tissue regeneration, and removal of the scar tissue. And that's when you can then start putting on full-strength helichrysum and frankincense, and those two are relatively safe and simple. And if you find that those are a little too strong, if it feels too drying, if it feels too strong to do that repeatedly, then dilute them down into a more typical dilution. But you can easily do 5 or 10%, which is pretty high dilution, actually, and quite safe. So I hope that I answered that in a politically correct way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, another call, Colleen?
Great, yes, many. I'm not sure, Donna, you have the mic. Were you ready to ask the question?
Hello, Donna.
I cannot hear you, so I'll put your hand down, and if you have a question, you can put your hand up again. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, and we'll go to Cher. Go ahead, Cher. You have the mic.
Great. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect.
Okay. I have a quick question about eucalyptus. It's one of those true or not kind of questions. I have heard that eucalyptus is an oil that should be avoided from people that have seizures or propensity to seizures, but I haven't come across anything myself that way. And if that is true, is that something that can also be applied to other respiratory oils?
You know, there's a lot of information about warnings and contraindications and things like this. But when it, you know, there's actually very little documented evidence that a lot of these reports are actually true. So I think that if there was a strong association with eucalyptus oil causing seizures at normal dosages and normal uses, that it would probably be common knowledge. Now, what I do know is that in poisoning cases where children or adults have consumed essential oil of eucalyptus, internally it will cause seizures, okay? So what I can say is if it is, if you consume it, if you drink it, seizures will happen as a result of central nervous system toxicity. That's probably where some of that information came from, and that's what has to be sorted out. Whether it is actually an oil that promotes seizures under normal, safe usage or not, I would seriously doubt it, okay? On the other hand, I'm always very, very cautious, and so what I would say is if you are on anti-seizure medication, don't use eucalyptus oil. Just common sense, all right? That's how I always go back to this, because these things are so scientifically vague a lot of times. There's so little information. There's so much conflicting information. A lot of it, you know, there's a lot of fraudulent claims that this is so safe, and those, and it's not. But there's also a lot of claims that it's so dangerous, and it's not either, okay? That's the problem. That's why it's such an interesting field. We have to find the middle path between exaggerated claims of danger and exaggerated claims of safety. So I would just say, yes, there's reports of people getting seizures, but that's because they drank it, okay? Then I would say common sense. If you have seizures, don't use eucalyptus oil. So that's about all I can say about it. But under normal use, put some eucalyptus in a diffuser, put a couple drops in the bath. If you don't have any history of seizures, I don't think it's a danger. That's how I would answer it. Is that helpful?
Okay, great. Yes, I don't have seizures. I just have heard the information come through, and I thought I'd ask.
Right.
Thank
well,
you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. But your question is very relevant because it really illustrates the other side of the coin that we have to be aware of. You know, last week I talked all week about how everybody's being told it's safe. But on the other side of that, there's so many people saying it's not safe, and neither are ultimately correct, okay? We really, really have to just sort things out because the oils can be very beneficial, and it depends on the oil, it depends on the adulteration in the oil, it depends on the medical condition, it depends on the individual. And here we are, 300 people talking by phone all over the world. We just have to frame it in terms of safe use. Go slowly with it, pay attention. And none of the oils that I'm going to be talking about, if you use them according to the principles that I am advocating, to the methods that I am advocating here, none of these things are going to hurt anybody. And so I'm hoping we can get to the end of 6 months and everybody can say, I only had benefits. I only had positive reactions. I had no adverse reactions. Okay, well, it's time for me to sign off, and it's time for all of you to continue this discussion by breakout groups and in the Facebook community. And for those of you who would like to know about the Facebook community, Colleen can tell you all about it. And also, she mentioned that there are some interesting stories going on over there, so I'd like to refer all of you over there. And she'll also tell you about the breakout groups. But before I sign off, I just want to show you the file of the deepening practices. And this is for you to do until we meet again in 2 weeks. And that is, number one, read all the files and the oil monographs. Okay, so you will be well prepared, and we'll cover the rest of the monographs first thing next week, next module. Continue practicing the method of contemplative aromatherapy. So if you haven't done it already, get some perfume strips. You can go ahead and do it out of the bottle directly in the meantime, but having perfume strips is very, very helpful for this course. As you sample the oils mindfully, become aware of the primary fragrance notes of each of the botanical categories, such as floral, spicy, camphoraceous, coniferous, etc. And in the monographs with each of those oils, there's a nice long list of those aromatic notes that are with lavender, eucalyptus, clove, the ones that are there. Number four, as you explore the aromatic notes of each botanical category, mentally review the therapeutic application of that group of oils, all right? So If you're smelling a floral oil, pay attention and remember that it is relaxing, cooling, low dermotoxic potential. And so that way, as you smell the fragrance, you are memorizing its effects. As you inhale each oil, pay close attention to the physical, mental, and emotional sensations that arise. And that way, you're going to learn directly from the oil about what it does. I'm telling you one thing. The files are telling you another thing. The oil will tell you another thing. You put those all together, you'll have a good comprehensive understanding of how the oils work. Number six, start using these oils from various categories, following the safety guidelines, observe their therapeutic effects. So now you can graduate to practicing aromatherapy for yourself. And so you know how to use the oils, dilute them, put them in the diffuser, don't drink them, and everything is going to be okay. And so with that, I will sign off and just say thank you to everybody. I very much appreciate you being in this course. And have a wonderful 2 weeks exploring your oils. And we will be starting the therapeutic modules in the next class, specifically on the respiratory system. And I will also be receiving all the webcast questions. I will post all my answers to that. Feel free to ask all the questions that you want. They will all get answered. And now I will turn it back to you, Colleen. And I will say thank you again to everybody, and thank you to you, Colleen, for hosting this. And I'll talk to everybody in 2 weeks.